A listener production. This is Global Truths with Dr. Keith Suter. Join us each week as we break down one issue in global politics so that you can understand what is going on in the world right now and what's likely to happen in the future. Our host, Dr. Keith Suter, is one of Australia's leading commentators on global affairs and geopolitics. My name is Sasha Barbagat. I'm a journalist. And this week on Global Truths, we're discussing the life, death and legacy of former Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev, who died recently at the age of 91. Keith, Gorbachev is an immensely interesting man, and I know you've personally met him. But before we hear about your experience with him, could you explain to us who he was and what his role was in global politics?
Yeah, so Mikhail Gorbachev was the last leader of the Soviet Union. So the Soviet Union wound up just over 30 years ago. In the end, he became a leader without a country. He came to prominence in the mid-1980s when, as a cabinet minister, to use our language, he visited London and met with Mrs. Thatcher. Mrs. Thatcher, at the end of the meeting, said, "This is a man with whom we can do business." That, in a sense, gave the Western seal of approval to Mikhail Gorbachev. And then the following year, he became General Party Secretary and so inherited the control of the Soviet Union. And of course, the Soviet Union in those days was much larger than it is today, because countries like Poland, Ukraine are all independent, whereas they were previously within that Soviet East European Empire. So he took over a country which was in decline. I'd be hesitant to say it was chaotic. I was traveling a lot behind the Iron Curtain in those days. And so I would say that it was a country that was stagnating. I actually wrote in one of my books about the challenge of the internet. You know, computers had just been invented. And I was intrigued as to how the Soviet Union would handle that problem. Because the Soviet Union was very good at doing basic things. So they could put people into houses, not particularly well constructed, but at least you didn't see people on the street. I look out of the window here in Sydney and I see homeless people. That was illegal in the old Soviet Union. That was a vagrant. That was a crime. So you had, as a government official, to make sure that there was nobody who was homeless in your area. But the home that they went into was not particularly well constructed, but at least they had a roof over their head. Same with food, very basic. So they could do things that were very basic, and they were able to concentrate on the manufacturing and the mining, because it's incredibly mineral rich, all that Soviet Union. And yet the problem was that there was an economic revolution underway. We were moving away from factories and mining across to the provision of what's called services. You and I are working in the service sector. Now, you've only got to tell from your sweet hands there, you do not grow food.
No.
You do not cut up coal.
I'm not in the coal mines.
Exactly.
No. In an office, safe and sound.
So we see this movement then in modern developed economies towards entertainment, law, accounting, finance. And of course, computers are an important component of a lot of that stuff. And the problem for the Soviet Union, it was an information vacuum.
Yeah.
So there was no map of Moscow, for example. You either knew where you were going, in which case you didn't need a map, or you didn't know where you were going and you might have been up to mischief, therefore you shouldn't be told.
Right.
Same with no telephone directories.
Yeah.
So it was always bizarre trying to get around. When I was there, I was always going to have to person in my last appointment get me to my next appointment because I wouldn't be able to do it on my own. So it was an information vacuum. And I did, as I say in this book, speculate on what would happen with the Soviet Union if, in fact, everybody had access to the internet. Oh, by the way, you were not allowed to own a printer.
You couldn't have a printer.
You couldn't own a printer because you would then print your own newspapers. So that was outlawed as well.
Okay.
So there was tight regulation on photocopying, printing, and that sort of thing. So I speculated on how on earth the Soviet Union would handle this new computer era, which was just beginning to get underway. And obviously Gorbachev was also aware of that problem. That was his difficulty. So he'd inherited a country which was stagnating. It wasn't chaotic, but it was stagnating. It was able to do certain things very well, but it was not able to cope with the whole new era. In economic terms, The Soviet Union was an autarky. In other words, an autarky is when you control all of your economic activities within your own borders. Mm-hmm. So we have an open economy. So we buy and sell stuff all the time overseas, etc. In the old Soviet Union, the money was controlled very tightly by government and spent on government projects. That's how they could put Sputniks into space, men into space, women into space, dogs into space, because they could just simply say, right, we are now going to do this as a national project, but we will not allow people to have so many cars or something like that. Same with toothpaste. You know, if you look at the amount of money which is spent on advertising toothpaste, in the Soviet Union, there was one brand, and that's it.
That's it, no choice.
No choice.
Yeah, take what you get.
So it's very basic, but it meant that they were able to control the economy. And as long as the economy remained fairly basic, it was okay. But Gorbachev could see that the Soviet Union, despite all of its scientific breakthroughs in outer space, he could see that, in fact, the Soviet Union was in trouble. And so wanted to reform the Soviet Union. Didn't want to destroy it. He just wanted to reform it. And so he used two phrases in particular, perestroika and glasnost, that were well known in Russian history. So they were not new words for Russians, which talked about restructuring and openness. But as I say, he wanted to reform the Soviet system, not bring it down.
So what did he do then? How did he start making those moves?
Well, I think the problem with Gorbachev is that he didn't understand why capitalism worked.
Right.
So in Australia, children grow up in a home where they hear the parents talking about things, they might well earn pocket money. So a fish doesn't know that it swims in water. And so we are being imbued with all the attributes of capitalism, being an entrepreneur, even as a child. Whereas in the Soviet Union, everything was provided by the state. So you could see Bolshoi Ballet, for example, if you were a Russian, you could see that for a few coins, not if you're a traveler. Luckily, I never went to the Bolshoi Ballet, but I did recommend the Russian state circus, which is politically incorrect because I use live animals. That's how I avoided going to the ballet. I said, I just want to go to the circus. And same with opera, again, just free of charge or virtually free if you were a Russian. So you've got these very basic things which they could do. The problem was that the system had no entrepreneurial get up and go. An example of this is that I spent one Christmas at Khabarovsk. So this is the Soviet Far East. So this is Siberia. It's on the Amur River, which is frozen. It really, with the snow, looked fantastic. And yet when I wanted to buy some postcards at the hotel, all of the scenes were boring summer scenes with boring Soviet buildings. None of these glorious. It was real snow. It was really fantastic being in Khabarovsk. So I inquired, why aren't you showing the snow scenes that I can see all around me? And they said, oh, well, we have a photographer who comes from Moscow. So that's 9-10 time zones away, comes over, and only wants to come in the summer to take the photos.
Okay, all right.
Because it's safer to land the plane, right?
Sure.
You know, when the plane lands, I'm the only person I know who's flown twice across the Soviet Union, because the Japanese plane would get me to Tokyo and then onto Moscow, but would actually fly over the top of Khabarovsk, wouldn't risk the landing, because you land on ice.
Which is pretty precarious.
Pretty precarious, exactly. And so the photographer didn't want to go during the winter season either. So they just had these very boring postcards. But I just thought, you know, imagine somebody from a more entrepreneurial society would realize, look, these are the winning postcards. These are the photos that we should be taking.
So that we entice people over here.
Exactly. Yeah.
Right. Okay. So I'd love to hear about when you met Gorbachev. What was he like? What sort of impression did he leave on you?
It's certainly a memorable impression. So Gorbachev, when the Soviet Empire collapsed, he then sort of had to reinvent himself. He'd become accustomed to all the limelight. By the late 1980s, he was more popular in the United States than President Reagan. So people were joking that they were to have him running for president. Obviously, he couldn't have done so.
No.
He was just very popular. But the problem was that the Soviet Union had collapsed. And so he then reflected on his experiences. So he became the Soviet leader in 1985. In April 86, we get the Chernobyl disaster in modern-day Ukraine. And he found himself relying for advice on what to do from the people who were responsible for the disaster in the first place.
Great.
So in retirement, he decided to create a new organization called Green Cross International, which advises people on environmental disasters. So it's a deliberate comparison with the Red Cross, which deals with humanitarian crises right. during war or earthquakes, etc. This deals with issues like would have been useful for him for Chernobyl. And so in the early 90s, he then became accustomed to working with us in the Club of Rome. And in fact, one of his colleagues remains still active. Towards the end of life, Gorbachev wasn't traveling very much. He was very frail. So I got to meet him in the early 90s in his retired state. And it was really quite amazing. My favorite example was the meeting that we had in Hanover in Germany. Walking around with Gorbachev is a bit like walking around with the Eiffel Tower. You know, the conversation stops, the heads turn around, etc. And the reason for that is that he is regarded as a hero in Germany. Let me just go back to November 1989. You got demonstrators who are pulling down the wall in Berlin. And Ulbricht, the East German leader, rings Moscow and says to Gorbachev, you must call out the troops, shoot these demonstrators. They're going to pull down the Berlin Wall. And Gorbachev said, no, the game's up. And he refused to deploy the Soviet forces and so avoided a German bloodbath.
So smart in retrospect.
Very smart.
Yes.
And made him a hero in Germany. By the way, on subject of avoiding conflict, it's worth bearing in mind Graham Allison, whom we've looked at in this series, the author of the Thucydides Trap, looking at the way in which you get arms races between countries. And in his survey, he looked at the way in which you have in the last 500 years, which are the 500 years in which white people have dominated the world, you've had 16 arms races, 12 of which have resulted in wars, such as between Britain and Germany and World War I, World War II. It's worth bearing in mind that Gorbachev ended the most recent arms race between the United States and Soviet Union without a shot being fired.
Mm.
So that's actually a plus that he was able to, when he came to office in 1985, he said, well, we'll surrender. It's as simple as that. And was then willing to work with President Reagan to cut back on nuclear weapons. So that's another reason why people have such a high regard for him, including Graham Allison at Harvard. Because for Graham Allison, even though of the 16 cases, 12 resulted in terrible wars, you do have four success stories, and Gorbachev is one of them.
This is Global Truths with Dr. Keith Suter, and this week we're discussing Keith's recollections of Mikhail Gorbachev following his recent passing. Now, we've been talking about his good reputation, I suppose, in the West. How's Russia and Russian people reacted to the death of Mikhail Gorbachev?
Oh, the Russians, although actually, I think on the day itself, there were people who were attending the funeral.
Mm.
Putin didn't, but other people did. Putin regards the collapse of the Soviet Union as one of the biggest catastrophes of the 20th century. What I find interesting is that although Gorbachev is a hero in the West, including to Harvard professors like Graham Allison, in his own country, he was loathed. So when he later on tried to re-enter politics and ran as a presidential candidate, he only got about 2.4% of the vote. So basically, ordinary Russians look back to that period of the 60s and 70s with nostalgia. The world seemed much more settled at that time. Everything was better organized than Russia today.
Mm.
Remember, the people who've done well in Russia are the entrepreneurial types. They were the ones who would have produced my postcards in Khabarovsk. Instead, what they did was to buy up in post-Soviet Russia all of the oil, energy, etc. They were the smart ones. They had the entrepreneurial mindset. Ordinary Russians didn't and still don't. And so they find today's Russia still a bit of a struggle. And so the further they get away from the old Soviet Union, the more they look back to nostalgia, back to the 60s and the 70s. And they hold Gorbachev responsible for ending that paradise that they thought they were living in.
Yeah, right. What did you think of Putin snubbing the funeral? Did you think there was no other alternative? Like, that's what he was going to do?
I think, yes. You know, he would say, well, look, I did look at the body. I paid homage to the body, an open casket. I did the minimum that would be expected of me. But yes, it was certainly, a poor showing and no state funeral. So yes, it's a bit of a tragic end for him. What is interesting is that Gorbachev died at the age of 91. The average Russian dies at the age of 76. So he actually outlived most of his country people who had been born back in 1931.
Yeah, definitely a man of might, it seems. You also had a really interesting story about meeting his wife. Would you tell us about that?
So I was at one of our Club of Rome meetings. I sat on their table. And it's very interesting with Reza, whom Gorbachev actually said it's the wife is the smart one in the family. Mm-hmm.
Always is.
And so listening to Reza Gorbachev, she'll be talking and then suddenly she freezes. And what you do is you just sit there, you don't move, and you just wait for her to resume the conversation. Now, what is happening is that in Gorbachev's final year in power, with the country collapsing, etc., there was a coup against Gorbachev. Now, Gorbachev and his wife were down at their Black Sea, Dhaka, their resort. And in Russian history, the first thing you do is you shoot your predecessors.
Right.
Because they definitely can't come back after the coup, right?
Ew.
And as Reza is talking, suddenly she relives that experience of August of 1991.
Mm.
And it traumatizes her. Oh. And then she sort of gets her sense of balance again. And then the conversation would flow on as though nothing had happened. But the interpreter warned us that this was a problem
for
Reza. And it was a really good love match, you've got to say. You know, they're all married for almost half a century. I think Gorbachev, towards the end of his life, he was a widower. He never remarried after losing his wife and really felt a little lost. And then secondly was the fact that he was loathed so much back at home by his own people. So he would have died, I think, a fairly disappointed individual, but an older individual than the most of his contemporaries.
And were you surprised with how his life ended up?
Yes, I call him the accidental hero because he's a hero to us in the West. He won the Nobel Peace Prize, very highly regarded. As I say, Graham Allison speaks highly of him and all the rest. So you've got all of those things, but he never set out to get that sort of achievement. What he set out to do very basically was to reform the Soviet Union. If you cast your mind back, I can remember it clearly, but you weren't born at the time. In 1968, in Czechoslovakia, there was a politician called Dubček,
mm-hmm.
who again became the party boss and tried to reform the Soviet Union. And in 68, the Soviet Empire decided that you're going too far and we will stop that. And the joke that was being used in the late 1980s is, where is Dubček? He's now in Moscow. Right? So Gorbachev was trying to recover what happened with Dubček. Let me just say, just for people who could remember those good old days of Dubček, he wasn't killed. He was sent out to look after a forest.
All right.
And then when you get the collapse of the Soviet Union and the country becomes independent, he is then called back.
Right.
And receives his honoured position. Dubček received an honoured position, tragically got killed in a car accident. Oh. Now, Gorbachev was basically trying to do the same thing, introducing social democracy, not setting out to destroy the Soviet Union. But of course, he did destroy the Soviet Union, angered Putin, but made him a hero for the rest of the world.
And do you think that's his legacy then? It'll be revered in the West, maybe not so much in Russia.
Absolutely, yep.
Keith, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts on Mikhail Gorbachev. Very interesting chat today.
Thank you.
Global Truths is presented by Dr. Keith Suter and me, Sasha Barber-Gatt. Audio production by Niall Fernandez. Theme and original music by Matt Nikolic. Listener.